Welcome. This is Interpreter Radio. I'm Martin Tanner. This is a fifth Sunday. With me in studio is Professor Dan Peterson. We have some fun topics tonight. During our second hour, we're going to be doing the Cumberland discussion.
You're listening to K-Talk Radio.
Well, we'll dispense with that. During our second hour, we'll be talking about Come Follow Me discussion, which is Doctrine and Covenants sections 23 through 26. And during our first hour here, we're going to talk about informal witnesses of the Book of Mormon and the new interpreter film on the witnesses of the Book of Mormon, which includes the formal and the informal ones. And I thought we would perhaps emphasize the informal ones because people know a little bit less about them. Before we jump right in, Dan, thanks for coming. It's always really fun for me to have you here. I enjoy it very much when you're in studio.
I'm happy to be here.
The Interpreter Foundation, for those who are familiar with it and for those who are not, is the sponsor of this program. The Interpreter Foundation is a nonprofit educational organization focused on the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it also focuses on church history, doctrine, responding to critics, and all kinds of fun topics. I highly suggest, if you haven't been there, go to the internet and type in interpreterfoundation.org. You'll find some wonderful things. You'll find Come Follow Me discussions, which Dan and I will be presenting next hour. You'll find scripture roundtables and discussions that date back now for many, many years and through all of the rotations of the scriptures and subject matters of gospel doctrine. You'll find a great journal that's been continuously in publication since the Interpreter Foundation was formed, and a number of wonderful other things. Add to what I just said, Dan, about the Interpreter Foundation.
Yeah, it's a really vibrant organization. It's it's produced books, sponsored conferences. We even have some trips coming up to Egypt and one, if COVID permits, to church history sites in July with the Cruise Lady Company. And we keep churning things out. As one critic said to me many years ago, "You're not very good, but my word, it's hard to keep up." Well, I'll sort of take that.
Well, you don't want the critics to think you're really good, or they might. Anyway, I'll leave that alone. But Van and I were talking about critics earlier today, and it's funny some of the sort of backhanded compliments that occasionally come your way, and I guess you'll take them the way you can get them.
That's right. Usually they don't compliment us, but yeah. Lately I've read that this film that we're doing is an attempt to take over the church, because the Book of Mormon is fundamental to the church. He who controls the Book of Mormon controls the church. Therefore, we're trying to control the Book of Mormon with this film and take over the church. So, anyway.
There's some very interesting logic there. So, first of all, to set the stage for our discussion of the witnesses, and particularly the informal witnesses, talk about the film project.
Yeah. Yeah, what we're doing, the Witnesses Film Project is a complex of things. Chief among them, I suppose, is a theatrical film, about 2 hours long. Not sure, it'll be a little less than that, I think, when it is basically finished, but I haven't counted the minutes lately. So, and that is a dramatic film telling the story of the witnesses over about a 10-year period. From their first encounters with Joseph Smith, through their experience with the plates and the angels, this is focused on the three witnesses, through Their departure from the church. All three of them left the church. And then, of course, there is a flash forward to, you know, what happened. Did they come back? Did they not? And the story is told as, to a certain extent as reminiscences of David Whitmer, who was the last surviving one of the witnesses, not just of the three, but of all of them. And so it's a very dramatic story. And one thing I found I need to warn some people about is this is not going to be, how can I put this? It's not going to be a visitor-centered film in the sense that it's going to be all sweetness and light and so on. There were struggles. There was strife. There were disagreements. There were bruised egos. And we bring up things, and a couple of people have seen, you know, prototype versions of the film have actually complained. Did you have to bring plural marriage into it? Did you have to bring up the Kirtland Bank failure? Did you have to do that? Yeah, I think we did. In order to tell the story honestly, truthfully, and, you know, to make it, it is a dramatic story, and we shouldn't try to pretend that it wasn't, but also it makes the light of the witness testimonies shine all the brighter against the turmoil, the fact that they never denied them, even though at various times they were angry, disaffected, alienated, and whatever. We had to show that. And, you know, plural marriage and the bank failure were among the factors that led to the witnesses leaving the church. I felt that if we're going to maintain credibility, we have to be honest about those things. We have to tell those stories. And then someone wrote to me just today and said, "You won't dare show the head and the hat and the seer stone." Oh, yes, we will. It's in the film.
You know, one of the things that has always amazed me about the critics is that they are after the church because the church doesn't focus on all the negative things.
Yeah.
And any organization, any person's going to have a bunch of negative things at some point or another. I mean, there is no perfect, pristine, pure organization. Even the church that you and I both believe is inspired and restored by God. Nevertheless, it's funny how people insist that the church is hiding something.
Yeah.
Because all these things aren't typically discussed, whereas they don't use that standard for any other organization. I don't remember seeing on the, I was going to mention a specific critic website, but I won't do that. You don't see on these websites, well, you know, we just had this meeting and we were all fighting amongst each other about this. I mean, no, nobody airs dirty laundry.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea is most people want to put forth their best foot forward, and they do that, and yet the church has been put in a position where if they do what everyone else does, they're criticized.
Right.
And so I like the approach that you've taken, or the Interpreter Foundation has taken with this film, and that is a positive message. But included in it are some of those trips and scuffs and bumps and bruises,
you know,
along the way.
Along those lines, I've seen some interviews lately with Lincoln Hoppe, who plays Martin Harris. And he is a member of the church. Now, our Joseph Smith is a member of the church, but our Oliver Cowdery and our David Whitmer, both young and old, are not members of the church. But Lincoln had something really interesting to say. He said one of the things he's really liked about this presentation of Martin Harris, he says a lot of people, when they think of Martin Harris, first thing they think of is the 116 lost manuscript pages. And he said there's a lot more to the guy than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't hide that story. We tell that story. We show a really kind of angry Joseph Smith responding when he first realizes what Martin has done. But Martin is redeemed, and very much so. And that's a kind of major sub-theme of the movie, is that that's not all he was.
I've always seen Martin Harris as the guy who had so much at stake when he was going to put up his farm that he listened, he had faith, but he also did his due diligence. He went off to to see Professor Anton and several others to see, well, is this all really right? I believe it, but let's get some experts involved. And I always like that. And also, he has a really good first name. So there are many reasons to, to like the guy. But I'm tongue-in-cheek there on the last one, of course. But I think he's been much maligned because of a dramatic era that was very, very open.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, he's in Scripture. He's reamed out. How would you like to be preserved in canonical Scripture as a bad example? That hurts. But Joseph is too. I mean, Joseph gets reamed out a few times too, so it's not like he aims it at everybody else but not himself. But there's some marvelous scenes in the film that to me are really touching, where Martin, there we go.
Yes, we are right there with Martin Harris.
Martin Harris, thinks that he sort of lost his soul, but he hasn't. You know, repentance is possible, and he ends up holding an esteemed position in the history of the church. And that's one of the things we want to remind people of.
Yeah, in the latter days of his life, up in Cache Valley, he gave some quite fiery and inspiring speeches, talks, addresses, however you'd like to describe them, about his experience with the Book of Mormon and the plates. And
yeah.
I've quite enjoyed reading some of those.
Oh, yeah. I did a fireside last night, virtual fireside for some people up. A lot of them in Bainbridge Island up in Washington, but others were from all over the place. I don't know how they all got together, but one of the people on it was Bruce Van Orden, who's an LDS historian. And he told a family story about something that Martin Harris said to an ancestor of his. And Bruce got emotional telling this. It is a piece of treasured family history passed down from generation to generation about what Martin Harris told his ancestor about the plates and his experience with the angel. And he got emotional telling it, and frankly, I got emotional hearing it. It's powerful stuff. And Martin is the only one of any of the witnesses to have made it out to Utah. The others didn't.
Let's talk about the purpose of the film, and then about some of the informal witnesses, Josiah Stoll and the rest.
Yeah.
He's one that fascinates me.
Yeah.
I like that because he's the guy who, was somehow misled by Joseph Smith in it anyway, and then here he is sort of backing up the whole story of the plates.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, the purpose of the film is partly to tell the story in a way that I think a lot of Latter-day Saints have not heard. There hasn't been much done, really, with the witnesses for a long, long time. And I remember a film, frankly, that had a huge impact on me when I first saw it, called The Three Witnesses. And it's told through David Whitmer's eyes. In that respect, sort of like ours, although ours is quite different. But I went back to it to look at it and think, well, could this one be dusted off and do the job? No. It was then 50 years old. That was 2 or 3 years ago. And it looked 50 years old. And I just thought, no. The production values would have to be so much better than this, good though it is. And I discovered, by the way, in looking at it, I think I'd already known it, that the expert advisor on it was Richard Lloyd Anderson, the great authority on the witnesses. And I can let the cat out of the bag that when this film comes out at the end, there's a dedication to Richard Lloyd Anderson, a witness to the witnesses, is what it says.
And he did such a phenomenal job with his book.
Yeah.
So when does the film come out? How can someone go see it and support Interpreter Foundation and learn more about the history of the witnesses? This is kind of the rest of the story, including the story that you probably know.
Right. The film we're hoping will be out this summer. It all depends on COVID-19 and vaccinations and everything else when the theaters open. We are frankly not going to premiere the film until the theaters are open. We don't want to premiere it only to have it guaranteed to fail. So we're looking at that. We have tentatively been thinking of June, somewhere in there, mid-June. I think that's still possible. We'll see. We're just saying right now, summer of 2021.
I wanted to bring that out because otherwise you and I and who knows who else will say, now, wait a minute, I didn't catch when that was opening, yeah. And it's indeterminate.
Right, it's indeterminate.
It soon.
You know, the film is ready, basically. It's going to be premiered in a way. It's not really a premiere, but it's going to be shown at the LDS Film Festival in the second half of February down in Orem. It is essentially ready, except the filmmakers tell me they still want to putter with the sound a little bit, and they're not sure that'll be quite right by that showing. And the funny thing is, I've seen it in multiple versions. They're all lamenting about the sound, and you know, I'm too much of a doofus to even hear it. But I get it. They're perfectionists. And but right now there is a website devoted to the film, witnessesfilm.com. I should have looked this up before I came. And if people go there, one of the things they can do is they can watch the trailer. And they can also, and I hope they'll do this, I hope they'll click on the button that says, you know, do you want to bring the film to your community? This is really, really, really important. I can't overstate this for getting the film out there and on the screens. Film theater owners need to know that somebody's going to come before they dedicate one of their screens to a movie. And this is especially vital for us beyond probably the Wasatch Front outside of Utah. But even in Utah, I think that if people would just go there, it doesn't imply that they don't have to pay any money or anything like that. Just leave their name and their zip code, whatever it asks. It's not very much. So that our distributor knows us, he can use that to build leverage to get the film released not only along the Wasatch Front in Utah and, you know, maybe southeastern Idaho and so on, but beyond. That's really vitally important to us. And we've also established a website for the Witnesses. It's called Witnesses of the Book of Mormon. I can't remember, dot something. I should have looked it up again, but I've been up visiting my 95-year-old father-in-law today, so I didn't get a chance to do what I wanted to do. But that website is really important. That's a backup item that we see as we hope a conversation will be started by this film. And we want to be participants in that conversation. So we're putting up a lot of stuff on that website. It's up as of last Monday. But we're going to be adding more and more, you know, the extant statements of the witnesses. There are many more of them than people realize, most people. And just all sorts of information about the witnesses, timelines, biographies, backgrounds. And there's a chance, too, for members of the church, if they want, to go on that site and bear their own testimonies of the Book of Mormon, to be up there with the witnesses. So that's an important thing. We're also, by the way, producing a two-hour, two-part documentary that we hope to have done, a docudrama at the same time as the film, for broadcast, for streaming. We haven't worked out all the details yet, but that'll provide the background, the commentary, with scholarly interviews. I've done a lot of those interviews myself with various scholars, including some non-LDS, and we're putting that up to explain what we're doing in the movie and why we're doing it.
Let's talk about the informal witnesses. Most members of the church are very familiar with the three witnesses and the eight, and these informal witnesses, maybe not so much. Some people might have heard, you know, rumors or stories or, you know, comments in a class, and they don't know if they're true or not. Let's jump right in here, yeah. And first of all, talk about who's Josiah Stoll. A lot of people listening will know, some will not, and then what does he have to offer? In what sense was he a witness, and how can this contribute to the validity or the evidence for the validity of the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, Josiah Stoll was a fairly prosperous farmer in the area, down around Colesville, that area in southern New York, and Joseph Smith worked for him for a while. And Josiah Stoll was interested in the story that Joseph was telling. And at one point, when Joseph has the plates, he hands them through a window to Josiah Stoll, and Stoll sees them. The cloth covering comes off the top of the plates, and he sees them and can describe them later on. And what's interesting about this is he does it under oath. during a trial where Joseph is actually being tried, and the prosecuting attorney obviously thinks Joseph's a fraud, he's swindling Josiah Stoll, and what evidence do you have that he has the plates? And Stoll says, I saw them. You know, it's good enough for me. I saw them. And I remember, this is one that was funny for me. I had not realized that until really relatively recently, a few years ago, when I was reading along in the transcript of that trial, and I thought, wait a minute, this is another witness. And the thing I like about it is some people have said about the 3 and the 8, well, you know, they were already believers. They were kind of pre-programmed. They were going out into the woods to have a spiritual experience. Josiah Stoll wasn't pre-prepared or anything. And it wasn't a group dynamic, group hypnosis, or group hysteria. It's on his own. He sees those. He's not expecting to see them. But he sees the plates. So he says, I know he has plates, or had plates. I think that's really important. The informal witnesses, to my mind, are much more important than I used to realize they were.
So in a nutshell, here's a guy who, at least in one court setting, is purported to have been taken advantage of by Joseph Smith, and of course the 1826 trial, and the people who have discussed that have Oliver Cowdery and others have stated. And by the way, if anyone wants more details, go look at Gordon Madison's fine article on that. But the gist of it is that here's a guy who supposedly was swindled by Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith's acquitted, and the guy who supposedly was taken advantage of is testifying that the plates are real because he saw them.
Yeah, yeah. That's powerful stuff. And so to my mind, for a long time I thought, well, the informal witnesses are just additional witnesses. You know, you have the 3 and the 8, and now you've got some more. No, I actually think they're a different kind of witness. They aren't experiencing this in groups. They're not prepared for what they are going to see. They haven't been psyched up. They see them sometimes very unexpectedly and still testify.
Be a little bit like the prosecutor saying, and ma'am, when you were walking across the street, didn't this man over here at the defense table steal your purse? No, he helped me across the street. Kind of messes up the case right there, you know.
Yeah.
That's a little bit
the
like what
prosecution
happened.
Kind of is floundering at that point.
That's right. When Josiah Stoll says something good, you can just see the guy. Oh,
yeah.
Help!
Yeah. No, this is powerful. In the theatrical film, there's a scene with Lucy Harris, and we often think very negatively of Lucy Harris. She was the one who made Martin Harris's life a living hell for a while, and you know, was involved with the loss, whatever happened to the manuscript pages first dictated. But she has an experience, according to Lucy Mack Smith, that she's told by Joseph that she can't see the plates. And so she says, well, I won't support this unless I have a witness. She goes home, and she has a dream or a vision or something, according to Lucy Mack Smith, where a messenger came to her and said, you've basically insulted the Lord's messenger, and this is not right. And now you take a look at these plates, and, you know, you should know they're real. It's interesting that in the film, we don't make a big deal about that, but it is mentioned in the film that Lucy Harris was one of the first donors, possibly the first donor, to help Joseph with his finances while he was translating. You don't think of her doing that. Something happens later on. But her first reaction is she has a dream or a vision. She sees a messenger, sees the plates, according to Lucy Mack Smith. And we do know that she gave money. Speaking of the trial where somebody, the alleged victim, makes a statement that undercuts the prosecution, that's exactly what she does. When the judge says, wait a minute, the only people here who were swindled, in when she's suing Joseph, the only two people here who were swindled were the plaintiff and her husband, and both of them gave the money willingly. This is folly, and he rips up the the complaint because there was no crime. There was nothing. They both gave willingly.
We have a timely text from your wife that the actual website is BookofMormonWitnesses.org.
Okay.
So here
Book
we are.
BookofMormonWitnesses.org. Yes. Thank you to my wife.
Yes. Definitely on top of things. So there we go. BookofMormonWitnesses.org.
Yeah, okay. BookofMormonWitnesses.org. Okay.
Fabulous. Yeah.
So people should go to that, and it will be growing over the next while. So
Mary Musselman Whitner. I think this is a great story, too. Messenger plates. Go ahead and tell this story. This is great.
This is a great story because it's so human. You know, Joseph and Oliver are in the Peter Whitmer, Mary Whitmer farm home, which you have to understand is not like one of our houses today. This is a tiny little place. And she's having to work to do, you know, feed extra people. People are constantly cruising by to gawk. They want to see what's going on. And meanwhile, Joseph and Oliver, these two able-bodied young men, are working every day at dictating and transcribing or taking dictation. And she apparently was getting a little upset about the workload. And then, to make matters all the worse, she goes out one day, and she's doing some of her errands and so on, milking the cows and all that sort of thing, and she sees Joseph and Oliver skipping stones on a pond. And she says, you know,
this is just not right. I am overburdened. I've got all this extra work, and you guys are skipping stones and
exactly.
Focus of attention and translating and do all these important things, and I'm just getting no credit.
That's exactly how she feels. And, you know, now I understand from Joseph and Oliver's perspective, these are young guys who are very young. They're vigorous. Joseph certainly is a farm boy. He's not used to being indoors in the darkness, you know, dictating and so on all day long for hour after hour after hour. I don't blame them for wanting to go out sometimes and skip a rock or something, just something. But from her perspective, it's insult added to injury, and she resolves she's going to toss them out. And so, to my mind, that's kind of, in a way, an existential crisis for the whole project. That's why divine intervention occurs, because they need a place where they can do this work. And so she's out one day working in the barn, milking the cows, and a stranger appears and says, basically, Mary, you know, all the burden's resting on you. You're under a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. So it's only fair that you should have a view of these things. And he has a backpack or a knapsack, and he opens it up and takes out the plates and shows them to her. So that for years afterwards, she describes them in detail. And we have lots of sources on this. David Whitmer talks about it. A granddaughter and a grandson separately all say, oh, yeah, she told this story all the time. She doesn't say that it's Moroni, and I have reason to believe it might not have been. I don't know who it was. She always called him Brother Nephi. Now, who was it, the Nephi of Third Nephi? I don't know. But she is, very possibly, the first person outside of the Smith family to see the plates. She may be the first witness, even before the official three and the official eight, that she saw the plates and had that experience. It's powerful.
Yeah, I've always found it fascinating that she came up with the name Nephi. To me, I've always assumed, but of course, one never knows because, you know, it's not like I can go dial her up on my cell phone or something if I want to know. But did she come up with that because she was told that that's who, hello, I'm Nephi? Or is this an assumption because she read the Book of Mormon and this is who she assumed? Or is there some other reason, and yeah, we just don't know.
We don't know.
It's fascinating.
But we never hear in her voice. We get accounts from her son and two of her grandkids, but we never hear it from her, and obviously can't cross-examine her or interview her.
Yeah.
But I think it's remarkable stuff. It's a remarkably powerful testimony. And, again, she wasn't expecting it at all. Totally surprised her. Actually scared her just a little bit. When the stranger suddenly shows up in the barn, she's never seen him before. She wasn't prepped for this. She wasn't in some sort of spiritual state. She's milking the cows, which, by the way, my father used to tell me about growing up on a farm in North Dakota, how he hated milking cows. He grew up in a strict Lutheran family. His mother was very strict. and was against swearing, and he said, so he said, you couldn't milk cows without swearing. It was not possible because you'd just get the pail of milk full and they'd stick their filthy hooves in it or, you know, hit you in the face with their filthy tail. You had to swear. And he used to reflect on the problem of evil. Why was it that his city cousins were going to go to heaven? Because they never had to milk cows. And he would go to hell because he had to milk cows, therefore he had to swear.
I think that's funny.
So anyway, you know, the fact is, I can't imagine when she was out in a foul mood milking cows that she was in a spiritual state saying, let me hallucinate an angel in plates.
Yeah. So correction on my part real quickly. The website is witnessesofthebookofmormon.org, witnessesofthebookofmormon.org, spelled out, no spaces.
Right. Witnessesofthebookofmormon.org.
Correct.
Okay, that's
and,
right.
And now that I've, I think, mentioned correctly the website here, speak to what this experience did to Mary Whitmer, because proof for me, or, well, proof, I hate to use that word, strong evidence that this is very, very real is how it affects her. This is not just some dream or a fantasy or an idea. This is very real because it affects her how.
She never complains again. You know, and I think a lot of people out there, probably the women especially, are familiar with the situation where the men are doing the important things, like watching the Super Bowl or you know, establishing world peace or settling political issues. Well, the women are doing all the work, right? And so I think you can understand this. It's very human. She is not happy. She's been just worked to death and is getting no credit for it. And they're out skipping rocks on a pond. After that, she's fine. And she remains a firm believer in the Book of Mormon to her dying day. To me, that speaks volumes.
It does. As I've over the years gone through the statements of the formal and informal witnesses, one of the things that has struck me, we'll kind of use this as an interlude between the informal witnesses, is that they're able to describe quite accurately how much they weigh. You know, Martin Harris, they between 40 and 60 pounds, and this is what they were like, and this is the size, and this is the shape, and the descriptions are all approximately 6 by 6 by 8 and somewhere between 40 and 60 pounds, and that's pretty accurate for something that didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
For the critics, how do you go about that? And I would think the books were cooked and that this wasn't real if there were no guesses, or if they were, you know, they were about 4 pounds and somebody else says, oh, 120, you know, then you might, but they're all within a reasonable estimate, and you would never expect all the statements to be the same. And I love the way these all sort of match up well.
Yeah, they do. And you have a statement from Martin Harris before he's one of the three witnesses. We got to hold the plates for a while in the wooden box, and he estimated them as being about 40 to 60 pounds. But he also makes a really interesting comment. He said, I knew, and you can tell that something's unusually dense. He said, I could tell this wasn't sand in there. It wasn't a rock. It had to be either lead or gold. And then he says something that I've always found really funny. I don't know if he meant it to be funny. He says, I knew it had to be either lead or gold, and I knew that Joseph had not sufficient credit to buy so much lead.
And certainly not enough for gold.
That's right. So. But yeah, the fact was, some people have said, well, he had bricks in it. No, Martin says it was way too heavy for that. It was exceedingly heavy in a small, compact space, which means it's some sort of metal like that. And so later on, they're estimating the weight and so on. They all come in around 40 to 60 pounds. And you know, I think one of the most impressive witnesses is Emma Smith. Actually spends time feeling the plates.
Yeah.
And she describes feeling under the cloth, you know, the three rings, and along the one edge, they feel like the thick pages of a book. And she moves the plate on top and feels it move and hears it scrape in a metallic way against the plate below. I mean, again, There's something really in there.
Yeah, let's add some more to the description here. Actually, there are very few paintings or reproductions or descriptions of the plates that are really accurate. They show rings, but these were D-shaped rings.
Yeah.
And the stated purpose for those was that you could put a piece of wood through those so that you could pick up this really heavy object. And people think, well, they don't think this through. Okay, go grab yourself a 40-pound weight from the gym and yeah. see how easy it is to walk around with it.
Yeah.
And if you had something that was, it had pages, something like that kind of a handle would make it very, very useful. So
yeah.
D-shaped rings. And another thought is that people think, well, if you weren't one of these formal witnesses, you never got to see him. Emma was around them all the time. She might have had more actual contact with the plates than maybe anyone because
yeah.
she was moving them around in connection with her household responsibilities.
Well, and the sheer nerviness of Joseph Smith, if he's faking it, he leaves them covered on a table in the cabin with no one around, just Emma. Emma could have exposed him in a heartbeat if they weren't real. Now, Emma always said that she never looked. I've always wanted to ask her, you know, come on, Emma. You know, I know what I would have done if I'm alone in a little cabin and there they are on the table and under a thin muslin cloth. I would have peeked. Yeah. Did you really not? She says she didn't. But she does say, I know my husband had the plate. I know he did.
And you talk about this cloth. The during that era, people had these linen smocks, if you will, work shirts. People didn't have quite the wardrobe that people do today. It was kind of a long sheet of linen. It had a bowl cut in the top, and you'd kind of throw it over your head, and then you could do work. It was kind of like a guy's apron, if you will,
right.
for work. And you worked hard, and that's what typically the plates were covered
yeah.
with, was one of those linen smocks.
You know, the weight is interesting. There's a scene, one of the very opening scenes in the theatrical film is Joseph Smith running in the woods with the plates being attacked by a mob. And some critics have said, you know, the fact is that's impossible. And you've mentioned how heavy the plates are. Well, I'll tell you one thing. And I've been mocked for saying this, but I'm sorry. We've done an experimental test on this, an empirical test. Our actor, Paul Wuthrich, who's in his early mid-20s, in good shape, but he's not a farm boy that's out pulling up stumps every day either. He ran with those plates, and we had two sets. We had one set that were about 30 pounds, 35, I think, and the other set were 45. Neither one of them light. And he sometimes used the 45-pound set because he wanted it to look authentic, you know. So here he is. No one, I mean, if you haven't been on a film set, you can't imagine how many times they retake scenes, even if they get them right, from different angles and all this sort of thing. So for hour after hour after hour, he's traipsing up the hill carrying those plates, then running down the hill, jumping logs, running through branches with those plates. When people tell me it can't be done, I say, you'll be watching it on film. And believe me, the sweat on his face and the matted hair, this was not cosmetics. We really gave him a workout that day.
Yeah. Well, it certainly can be done.
But it's hard.
But it is very difficult.
It would help to have a mob after you. And it would help to be in really good shape and to be running for your life.
Yeah.
And have that shot of adrenaline. But I don't think he ran nonstop like a sprinter for 2 miles. But he was going as fast as he could
right.
in spurts. And then just the records say that when he got to the house, he was absolutely exhausted.
He was exhausted,
yeah.
Sure. You know, I have a son who joined the Marine Corps about a year and a half ago now. Well, almost 2 years ago now. Part of the boot camp, Marine boot camp's not like some of the other boot camps. It's 100 days, and there is a lot of very intense, long-term, you know, hiking, packing, moving things around. Things like this 40 to 60 pound. In, hey, it could have been 60. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Things like that can be done by someone who is young and in good shape. It's done all the time in the military and in other contexts. And Joseph Smith was in very good shape. Here's a kid, a young man. I call him a kid. I guess compared with me now, he really is. But he was a young man who was in extraordinary condition from all of the work that he had done. Of course he could do that.
Yeah.
Of course he could do that. And if somebody said, you got to do it for 5 miles, I suspect that he could have gone further. I don't think he was probably at the very end of his abilities, right, just based on what I would surmise about him. But it was a significant amount of effort. It was very, very great effort and strain for him to do that.
But again, it implies that story is true. Clearly, there was a real physical object there.
Yes.
And that's important. I mean, I wrote a little piece for Richard Bushman just the other day. He's doing a book on, timing is great from my point of view, on the cultural history of the plates. You know, how they've been viewed by Latter-day Saints, non-Latter-day Saints over the years. And so he's got a little section at the end where he's going to have a few people, LDS and non-LDS, write, you know, a paragraph or a page about what the plates mean to them. So I wrote a piece for him, just a page long. But I said one thing, the plates by themselves, let's leave out the voice of God, the angel, all those sorts of things. If there really were plates, and the evidence seems to me overwhelming that there were, of some kind, wherever they came from, then that takes the Joseph Smith story out of the realm of subjective fantasy. A lot of historians of religion want to look at Joseph and say, well, he was a good-hearted kid, you know, who meant well, but he was just imagining things. No, there was a real physical object of considerable density and weight there. And, you know, I think the point is important. There's a Mrs. Palmer who we don't even know her first name, but she was a young girl when Joseph was young and worked for her father in the area. And she said, well, when he had the first vision, a lot of people came to my father and said, you shouldn't employ this kid. You know, he's a blasphemer. They said, no, the first vision was just the pure dream of a pure-hearted boy, and an innocent dream. She said it was when the Book of Mormon came along that Dad said, uh-uh, this is fraudulent. Well, it forces the choice. You can imagine a kid having a dream of God. But when he's got 40 to 60 pounds of metal or claiming to have it, he either does or he doesn't. This is not something you fantasize about.
And this might be a good time to bring up the dichotomy between critics today. Oh, it was all made up and it was in everybody's mind. Back then, everyone, even the critics, believed they were real. They just maybe thought, oh, they weren't from God, or Joseph Smith found these, or maybe we can sell them somewhere. He had some offers like that, or, you know, different ideas. But they were real, even to the skeptics and the critics. And maybe this is a good time to talk about Emma's father, who was unconvinced, but nevertheless a witness about the reality of these.
Yeah, even the money diggers around there were convinced he had them. They wanted to get them. We also have witnesses, by the way, who say they saw the remnants of the stone box in the hill that had broken into fragments and washed down the hill, but they saw it.
Yes.
So again, material, tangible, real. But Isaac Hale didn't like Joseph. He wasn't happy about Joseph marrying his daughter. Claimed that she ran off without his permission. Well, she was actually old enough. She didn't need it. But he wasn't happy about Joseph. He didn't like him. Didn't like the money digging rumors about him, things like that. So he hears stories, though, about a book. And Joseph lets him hold the box with the book in it, the plates. And Isaac Hale wants to see it, and Joseph says, no, you can't. I can't do that without divine permission. Isaac Hale says, well, you can't have an object in my house that I can't see. So take it out somewhere. Get it out of here. But even Isaac Hale is saying he had an object. Now, Isaac Hale, I think, would have said it was fraudulent, you know, however he did it. But he has a physical, tangible object. It's not just dreamy, chuckle-headed Joseph. imagining these things, somebody has made plates. The question that has to be decided is, are they ancient? Are they divine? Are they modern and fraudulent? But that there were plates, I think, is really clearly established. And that takes us a long way down the road we need to go.
It absolutely does. William Smith.
Yeah. William Smith is another one who says that he felt the plates, he held them. He estimates the weight at 40 to 60 pounds. He says they were very heavy. Lots of people comment they were extremely heavy. And so he's a witness, even though he's not one of the official ones, to the tangibility of the plates. When Joseph came in, he shoved the plates at William, and William took them. And William was younger than Joseph, so a teenager. But he said they were extremely heavy. He emphasizes what you might call the physicality of the plates. He didn't see them, but he hefted them. I like the word that the eight witnesses and others use a lot, hefted. I think it's related to our word heavy. They lifted it. They had to heave it up, and it took effort. To heft something implies you're not hefting a feather. You're hefting something that resists your effort. Yeah.
And another fascinating point for me about the plates is that they're described as being golden in appearance, but not made of gold, even though some people assume that's what's being described. Now, if you calculated out something that was 6 by 6 inches by 12, if it were pure gold, you would have a number of problems. At the very least, something like that would weigh approximately 250 pounds, not 40.
Yeah.
Would also be way too soft to be useful for anything. And so what we almost certainly have is some kind of a gold alloy or some other alloy that's very, very heavy because it's metal that has the appearance of gold, which is kind of the operative phrase.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, but if it's a gold alloy, then that reduces the weight because almost all metals are lighter than gold. Gold is extremely heavy. And then another thing you have to remember is it's not a block of metal. It's plates, and so there's air between them, and there's the space of the inscriptions. I mean, it creates some air between those plates, so it's not a solid block of solid, pure gold. That's where a lot of critics have made a mistake when they do their calculations.
Yes.
If it's copper mixed with gold as an alloy, then it's considerably lighter.
And, of course, the whole idea of solid gold is just impossible because it would not be usable, it would not be durable.
Right.
And so some kind of an alloy is almost certain from that standpoint as well.
Yeah. We know they were very heavy, but they weren't as heavy as some people have tried to make them.
Not nearly as heavy as if they had been made of pure gold.
In fact, if you do the calculations, some people have done this with a gold alloy that we know existed in the pre-Columbian Americas called tumbaga. You calculate
right.
that
Where are
out.
The gold plates, tumbaga? Great,
right.
great little article
right.
about that, yeah.
Reed Putnam. But if you do the calculations, they come out to about what William and Martin Harris estimated the weight was. It's about right.
So, what do you know about the cultural history of the? I'm a little off topic here of the plates book. I mean, this sounds fascinating. And maybe there's not much you can say but
I don't know a whole lot about it. I know he's been puttering with this for several years. I know I'll tell you this. I've heard some people try to suggest that Richard Bushman is an unbeliever. I'll tell you, he is not.
Yeah.
He will tell you, and he says it in an interview with us on film. He said, if people want to know, I come down on the side of plates and angels. You know? So
yeah.
He believes the plates were real, and he says, if you try to get them out of the picture, you have to throw out all the primary source data. Now, the trouble is, if you do that, you can tell any story you like. Just throw out the sources.
Sure.
There's no discipline on you anymore.
Yeah. I had that same impression when I interviewed him when Rough Stone Rolling came out.
Yeah.
And people read that. I think the you know, rumors about him not being a true believer come from reading that book. They, oh, a real believer, they wouldn't have put all this negative stuff. Well, of course they would have. He's trying to be very, and sometimes I even think maybe gives a little too much away, but that he is very careful to be very inclusive and to include everything that's credible and maybe even a few things that aren't, because they occupy a great place in history.
Right. I think you could criticize that book for being nodding a little too much in the direction of critics. I can regret that, but I do know for a fact that he's a believer, and he'll say it outright. And I know there's a theory out there. I won't name the person. There's a very eminent scholar out there, a non-believer, never LDS, who nevertheless recognizes the evidence is overwhelming. There were plates, that Joseph wasn't dishonest, that Joseph wasn't crazy, nor were the witnesses. And so what she tries to have is that Joseph created the plates and then somehow believed that God touched them with his metaphorical finger and transformed them into Nephite plates, even though there were really no ancient Nephites. And so Joseph was really sincere and all this sort of thing, which to me is really convoluted and crazy. But it may be the best an honest historian can do with the data without accepting it. And I have Richard Bushman, since we've been talking about him, on tape giving his response to that theory. We are not going to use it because it's a little rough about what he thought of that particular theory. But I can say, he says, well, but it's flattering in a way. It means this historian has conceded. The witnesses are credible. They're sane. They're honest. There almost certainly were plates. Now what do I do? He says, we're in a good position on this.
And we are. Mention, if you will, just a little bit as in our last few minutes, Stephen Anderson's comments. You say there's a statement there at the end or whatever it is at the end of the movie. Or I'm sorry, Richard Anderson.
Yeah.
I'm calling him by the wrong name. Talk about Richard L. Anderson's place in the film. And then, again, tell people about the film and you know, when it's likely to come up, because I think some people have probably
tuned in later.
Yeah.
Or have tuned out for much of it.
No. This is great stuff.
But, yeah, Richard Anderson, the film is dedicated to Richard Anderson because, to me, he was the great authority on the witnesses. Pioneering authority, meticulous historian, who deserved, in a way, I think, a lot more credit church-wide than he typically has gotten. I'll tell you, I was once sitting in the back of, dare I say it, a rather boring Sunday school lesson. And so I pulled out my copy of Richard Anderson's classic book, Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses, and began to read it again. And a member of our high council, who is now retired from the religious education faculty at BYU, I'll give his name, Kent Jackson. Some people will know that name. Kent came over and sat down next to me and said, what are you reading? And I showed him that. And he said, you know, I think next to the scriptures themselves, that's the most faith-promoting book I've ever read. And that's Richard Lloyd Anderson, Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses. Now, that's not all he wrote on the subject. He went on to write very important articles and so on. But that's the starting point. And so, to me, he's the patron saint of the subject, of this particular topic. But the film, Witnesses, will come out with its accompanying documentary. But the theatrical film will appear on movie screens as widely as we can get it distributed this summer. And we'd love people to go to our witnessesfilm.com site and ask it to come to their community. Sign up, press the button, you know, click on the button, and say, I want it to come to my community. This is important to us to get it out there. That is that's the one for the website about the witnesses. The one of the film where the trailer is and where you can sign up is witnessesfilm.com. So we're starting to multiply websites. I hope it won't be too confusing. We also have a Facebook page and all sorts of things. But we're going to be rolling this out and telling the story over and over and over again, so I hope people will see it. But I really want them to go to that site and ask for the film to come to their town. Even if you live along the Wasatch Front, it's not guaranteed that the local Megaplex or Cinemark or whatever is going to play the movie. They have to know that people want to see it. So please do that.
We're back. This is the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. The Interpreter Foundation is an organization formed to defend the LDS faith, to do scholarship and research on scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and to do other faith-promoting works, including, as we have talked about last hour, discussing a recent film project dealing with Book of Mormon witnesses. During this segment, during this hour of our program, we are discussing Come Follow Me lesson on sections 23 through 26. The theme of this lesson is strengthening the members of the church, strengthening the church. And I've always, Dan, been fascinated with these sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, because these are at least somewhat unique. As you think about Old Testament and New Testament scriptures generally found in Christianity, do you have stuff that's just addressed to an individual? Well, yeah, some of Paul's stuff. You know, you've got Timothy and Titus, right, and they're pretty directed. And you've got some very pointed statements here and there in the Old and New Testament directed to individuals. But they're still not quite like this.
Right.
This is pretty unique and a little bit different.
Yeah. You know, I think the Doctrine and Covenants, one of the things that makes it fun is you see what I think may be the sort of thing that would be the raw materials for some of the other scriptural books, like Chronicles and so on. Somebody has written those based on correspondence in the court and, you know, little snippets of information here and there, and put them together into a narrative. But here you have the raw material. This is the historical data as it's happening in real time. So it's kind of fun. And when you talk about strengthening the churches, I mean, here we are. We're talking about mid-1830. The church isn't all that big. We're talking about a few dozen people, maybe. This is at the very, very beginning. It only started with six official members on April 6th of 1830.
Yeah. So I've heard estimates that, you know, 50-ish, give or take 10 or so, somewhere in that range, and that's about right. Two comments. The first one is that in this context, with so few people and in such a new organization, here you are. I mean, COVID's been around now a lot longer than the church.
Right.
I mean, that's just, and here, I'm not sure that was a great analogy or not, but the point is that this is so new and so fresh. People are caught up with the belief in the new faith, and the miraculous part of it for me is, among other things, these wonderful pronouncements that you have, and some of those have been explored in previous lessons about a marvelous work and a wonder. It isn't, well, we got this new organization, let's kind of see what we can do until we build things up. You know, I mean, that's kind of what you'd find in a business context. No, this is a marvelous work. This is a wonder. This is a phenomenal thing. This is amazing. And in that context, these sections 23 through 26 of the Doctrine and Covenants are faithful adherence to this new restoration faith. Close associates of Joseph Smith who are coming to him saying, please find out what God's will is for us. Give us something, if you could, that's inspired by God to direct us, and hence we have these sections.
You know, I thought today, with the church being so much larger, incomparably larger, imagine these people looking forward to seeing what the church is today. They would have been astonished. In some ways, not astonished, but in other ways, blown away by it. There weren't that many people within 500 miles of them, you know, all totaled. But a lot of these sections, these revelations here, are the kind of thing that we get now, maybe, for example, in patriarchal blessings. It's individual revelation, in a sense, individual scripture for us. But in the church as a whole, you simply can't have the president of the church receiving revelation for every individual member about what he or she ought to be doing right now, today, tomorrow. And so, you know, so that's kind of turned into a localized phenomenon. You go to the patriarch and he gives you this sort of information about what you ought to be doing and what you can look forward to. But, you know, one thing struck me in reading this, it occurred to me, and I'm not sure I'd thought of it really before, but in section 24, verse 3, where it says, you should go speedily unto the church which is in Colesville, Fayette, and Manchester. Those are the three centers. And basically, we know who they are. Colesville, it's the Knight family. Fayette is the Whitmer family. And Manchester is the Smith family. Give or take a few individuals, that's about it. That's what you've got. That's where the church begins. Colesville has been described sometimes as the first organized branch of the church, which is basically the Knight family. But there are three families, extended families, not very big extended families. And that's it. I'm pleased. I'll mention it now because this doesn't really count all that much for me, but I'm a descendant of Joseph Knight Sr. And I remember when I first found that out, I had been on a mission with a person who was a descendant of George Q. Cannon. And he knew every relative he had to the, you know, fourth cousin, 17 times removed level, and all that sort of thing. And I kept thinking, man, I come from nobody, you know. As a missionary, I think I held the highest office ever held by anyone in my family. And some of them were, you know, populating jails in parts of southern Utah. And we had, you know, not the most distinguished LDS line. And then when I discovered that I was descended from Joseph Knight Jr., Joseph Knight Sr., I thought to myself, good grief, we go back before there was a church. You know? Now, what does that matter? It doesn't matter at all. You know, God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. But nevertheless, it was kind of fun to find that I had a connection with these really, really early members. It was tenuous. The family didn't always keep its end of the bargain up. In the generations leading up to me, but we had that link.
Which is fascinating. I know a little bit about Joseph Knight Sr. As I recall, he was a Universalist before he mm-hmm. joined the church, and so he probably would have had some fairly liberal ideas about Christianity and, you know, and prayer and religion in general, yeah. And this would have been a pretty significant change for him to join the faith.
Yeah, I think it was. But, oh, he was committed. You know, the Knight family has been called the second family of the Restoration. Once they were converted, they were absolutely faithful.
Let's talk about some of the details here in section 23. One of the fascinating ones is about taking up your cross.
Yeah.
And some people in the church find that a little bit odd because we don't particularly, you know, worship the cross or focus in on somehow the crucifixion. Our emphasis is on the resurrection. But the meaning here is a little bit different. This is kind of a metaphor for, you know, bearing a heavy cross or some kind of challenge or difficulty or trial or something that's maybe worthwhile but isn't easy.
And I think that's consistent with our unwillingness to glorify the cross.
Yes.
We see the cross as a negative thing. And it was an instrument used to torture the Son of God, but he defeated it. So for us, if you could do a symbol of an empty tomb, That would be more like it. Or now the symbol we do use is the resurrected Christ welcoming all with his arms extended as of, you know, just a year or so ago that was established as the church symbol. It's the risen Christ, not the suffering crucified Christ that is our symbol. Important as the crucifixion and the atonement are, he defeated death, he defeated sin. So it's used here negatively, take up your cross. In other words, it's a burden.
It is a burden. But I've often seen this in the context of there must needs be opposition in all things. It's not, well, there kind of might be, or there could be a few that you run across. Well, there has to be. And in this whole idea of opposition and taking up your cross is bear those things that you're challenged with well, because they have to be there. They're for your good. People typically grow more when they encounter difficulties than when it's a bed of roses and you have grapes to pop in your mouth. You know,
yeah. That kind of thing. You know, when I was serving as a bishop, I was a bishop in a young single adults ward. And sometimes people would come in and they had horrible stories, and they were terrible stories. I had kids in my ward who were literally orphans. They needed financial help, and the stake president would say, well, be sure they go to their family first. And I said, their family are dead. Literally, they're dead. Or in a couple of cases, the mother and father are both in prison. You know, but there were a lot of stories that were tough. And there were times when I'd tell them, you know, look, I'm sorry. I mean, words are cheap. I say to you, I'm so sorry that you're facing this. And you've got to face it. We can help you in some regards, but you've got a tough road to hoe. But then I said, remember that you can react to this in two ways. You can become bitter and throw up your hands, surrender, whatever, or you can resist it and overcome it. And it's easy for me to say, because you're the one that's going to have to do it. But I said, if you went to the gym, would you want to work out with quarter pound weights? You know, take up a bar and, you know, curls, arm curls with a 2 ounce bar. You wouldn't. I mean, resistance is what builds strength. It's pushing against something. It's, if you're swimming or running, it's trying to go a little faster than you did before. And does it hurt? Yeah, it does, but it gives you greater capacity. Again, talk is cheap. I can say that to you, and I all I can do is express sympathy. But resistance is what this life is about, and it's always there. Nobody gets out of here. If you ask anybody, you can look at people and think, oh, they've led a charmed life. They've had no problems at all. No, they always have. If you knew the story, you'd know there are things they had to deal with in their family or health-wise, or any number of things. And that's what makes us what we are.
There's this short little verse, 23:3, that's directed to Hiram Smith. And it says, wherefore thy duty is unto, wherefore thy duty is unto the church forever, and this because of thy family, amen. And I've looked at that and tried to see it from the perspective at the time it was given. Because when you look back, you say, oh, Hiram Smith, church patriarch, you know, great things to come.
Yeah.
At the time, he might have been kind of scratching his head thinking, duty to the church forever because of your family?
Yeah.
How does that really work? But I think over time, the real import of those words would have been made clear. But it probably wasn't at the time. I certainly wouldn't have understood it.
No, I don't think any of them could have understood at that point what this would entail. It's like the fishermen on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, come follow me. Did they really know what they were getting into? I've sometimes wondered about Joseph Smith. Did he ever think back and say, you know, when I went into that grove, I just wanted to know, should I be a Methodist or a Presbyterian? I didn't expect
and
this.
And can my sins be forgiven? Yeah. And those were the two biggies.
Right.
Yeah.
And now look what's happened. Maybe I shouldn't have asked. But, you know, I've had that experience sometimes where people have told me, you shouldn't have raised this issue, but now that you have, and then they unload on you something much more than you expected. But, yeah, I'm thinking, could he have imagined in 1830 your duty is with the church forever because of your family? But, in fact, it was. His life revolved around the church, and, frankly, his family has continued to be that way. It's his descendants, not Joseph's, who've been presidents of the church, members of the 12, and so on.
Very, very true. The Joseph Smith side of the Smith family have recently become more involved, but that's more recent.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very good point. Great point. What else would you like to say about Section 23, if anything, before we jump to Section 24?
Well, there's so much to talk about in these, but I think it's interesting that when Oliver is addressed, he's told to beware of pride. And I'm not in a position to judge Oliver. I mean, Oliver was called to be one of the three witnesses. I was not. You know, and Oliver helped to choose the first 12 apostles. I wasn't asked to do that. So it's not for me to look down on Oliver. But I look at him and I think, was pride a factor when he finally did have his falling out with Joseph? He had a hard time sometimes, I think, saying, well, how come Joseph is the leader? Even when I don't agree with him necessarily. I mean, I stood in the presence of Peter, James, and John. I stood in the presence of John the Baptist. I helped translate the Book of Mormon. And yet he's the leader and I'm not. And I think there came a time when Oliver was chafing under that authority. He didn't agree. He didn't like what Joseph was doing. Now, the ideal would have been to submit, but it was that's easier said than done. And he was the second elder of the church. So I wonder if pride, if this wasn't prophetic in a very real way in terms of telling the future.
I've always looked back and not forward. I like your looking forward. When I read about the pride being an issue, I think to the efforts to translate. And, oh, you took no thought, save it was to, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the gist of it is you just thought it would happen automatically. You didn't put real effort into this. That kind of has a little bit of a sense of pride attached to it, or at least that's kind of the way I've seen it. Maybe that's unfair not being in his place.
But. You know, I think he was better educated, marginally, but better educated than Joseph Smith. Joseph, I think, was very aware of the fact that he couldn't write. He wanted a scribe, and I can't imagine that it didn't sometimes enter into Oliver's mind, I'm the guy here with the better education. I'm a school teacher. He's a farmer. Why am I not at least equal with him?
Fascinating comment, and certainly one that had Oliver taken perhaps a little greater to heart. Things might have been a little different, but still fascinating statement. Other comments about Section 23?
Oh, I think we can go on to 24.
24.
I do like the fact that it's Joseph Knight's duty to unite with the true church. He hasn't done it yet. He's been on the fringes. I mean, he just hasn't literally taken the plunge. But the Lord is saying, okay, it's time.
Time to join.
Yep.
Time to actually formally join.
Commit.
Yeah. So. Great point. Section 24, during April of 1830, Joseph Smith spends a lot of time at the Knight place in Colesville, and the Knights are listening to Joseph Smith's message, and a lot of things happen. There's opposition. There are people who are trying to present or prevent baptisms, but people do join the church. And after Joseph returns from Colesville to Harmony, then we have this revelation or inspiration that we know now as Section 24. And sort of the theme of this is declare the gospel like the voice of a trumpet. I mean, just proclaim it loudly in essence. And this, I think, is fascinating because of the whole context. This is the time frame when Joseph Smith hauled into court. There were all kinds of difficulties that were going on, persecutions there, and instead of, well, let's hunker down and weather the storm, it's let's declare the gospel with the voice of a trumpet as if from an angel. I've, again, been astounded at how... at how unlikely that would be without inspiration.
Yeah. Well, and it was tough. I mean, Harmony never does become a center of the church, except that Joseph is there. But they don't develop a huge congregation. That's where Isaac Hale lives, his father-in-law, and even he doesn't like him much. A couple of the sons of Isaac Hale, who are scribes for the Book of Mormon, never join the church. It's not very receptive soil. But even there, they're supposed to proclaim the gospel and to continue calling upon God's name, upon God in my name, it says Jesus' name, and you'll be given words. It shall be given thee in the very moment what thou shalt speak and write, and they shall hear it, or I will send unto them a cursing instead of a blessing. That's aimed especially at the people in Fayette and Manchester and in Colesville. But also I expect it's given in Harmony. And Harmony, well, I don't know how many people out there have been to Harmony. It's hard to find in a way. There is no Harmony anymore. It's Nineveh, which is really interesting, by the way, as a replacement for the name.
Yeah.
But Harmony Township is effectively no more. There's no Harmony Town. If you look for it on a map, you won't find it. It's easy to get to once you figure out what's going on. And by the way, let me say, the church's visitor's center there, which is quite new, dedicated by Elder Russell M. Nelson not long before he became president of the church, is one of the finest visitor's centers in the church. Historically, it's just really well done. So it's a bit out of the way, but extremely worthwhile.
Worth going to. That's a great tip. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Another tidbit for the background of Section 24 is this would have been just prior to the time that the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods were restored. And the allusion that I made earlier to legal difficulties, at least according to second and third hand sources, were in connection with the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood, which is a story that's not widely known. But despite the difficulties in the background that were going on, the church is progressing. Mm-hmm. The priesthood's restored. People are joining the church. And this revelation, section 24, happens telling people to proclaim the gospel.
Right, right. There's another interesting thing here that strikes me. This is given to Joseph Smith. It says, verse 7, "For thou shalt devote all thy service in Zion, and in this thou shalt have strength." But then go down to verse 9, "And in temporal labors thou shalt not have strength, for this is not thy calling. Attend to thy calling, and thou shalt have wherewith to magnify thine office." That is, if you attend to your responsibilities, you'll have enough that you'll survive. But temporal things are not your strength. And that's absolutely true over Joseph's life. Now, if I were to contrast him with Brigham Young, there are lots of ways of contrasting him. Brigham had a gift for practical management, administration, that sort of thing, that I think Joseph didn't. And I don't mean to badmouth Joseph, but I thought to myself, could Joseph have led the trek westward? I'm not sure. Brigham Young did magnificently. Was this Joseph's wheelhouse? I don't think it was. Brigham used to laugh that they set Joseph up with a shop in Nauvoo. He just gave it all away. People would come in, give him a sob story, and say, "It's okay, take the stuff. You know, no need to pay. You can pay me later." And of course, they didn't. And Brigham said that Joseph was a terrible businessman in that regard, and partly because of who he was, people would come in and say, "If he doesn't give me this flour for nothing, he's no prophet of God." And so Joseph would give it to them. But he wasn't a great businessman. He never became rich. Some people have said he went into this line of work, prophecy, you know, to become rich. If he did, he was a miserable failure at it.
Yeah, it's the critics have always astounded me on this because I've often said, "Oh yeah, I remember that letter that Joseph sent to Oliver that said, gee, if we can sell more of these Books of Mormons, we're just going to get rich." There's no such letter.
No.
There is no such letter. As a matter of fact, I have, because early on in my dealings with the critics of the church, this kind of thing had been brought up. I thought, well, let's keep looking. And I've always kept my eye out for anything that might even remotely look like some kind of a profit motive or an expectation of wealth. You can scour the Joseph Smith papers. It is not there. You can scour third-party comments about Joseph Smith from people who he actually knew, not critics who threw rocks at him. You cannot find it. It is not there.
No. No, the evidence from his papers, I think one of the great contributions of the Joseph Smith papers is as you read his letters and so on from very early on, if this guy was not sincere, then I'm a leprechaun. I mean, it's transparent on every page. Yeah. He believes it. You can just reading those letters, you might conclude, well, he's sincere but crazy. If you don't want to believe him. But you can't conclude he's insincere. There's not one trace of it, even in the most private letters to his wife and his children, and descriptions of what he does. He's really upset at one point, so he goes into the woods to pray, which indicates you this is the kind of thing Joseph did, not just in the first vision story. When he was troubled by something, he'd go into a private place in the woods and pray. He does this all the time, and there are prayers in his letters. Oh God, bless thy servant. You know, bless his family, help me to do this and this and this. And he's transparently sincere. That's why, I think the plates are so significant, because if I don't want to believe Joseph, I have two basic choices. He's either not sincere and he's cheating, or he's crazy.
Right. Well, he's either crazy or a conscious fraud.
Right.
And neither one of those work.
They don't work. I mean, I remember a certain critic, my late lamented friend Bill Hamblin, tried to pin him down one day. He said, okay, let's assume, as you say, there were no plates. Did Joseph know there were no plates, or did he think there were plates? And the fellow knew he was cornered, and he said, yeah, I'm not going to lower myself to your simplistic dichotomies. But that's the real question. To me, Joseph's sincerity is clear, and the fact that there were plates seems to take craziness off the table, too. There really is something there. It's not just pure, subjective, nutcake stuff. And he gets nothing out of this, except a shortened life and substantial time in prison under miserable conditions and mob violence and tarring and feathering. Anyway.
I used to have a critic call on the show that I did, and I used to ask him that very thing. All right, so what was Joseph's motivation? And that's the problem when they come up with these different theories. It's a paper tiger. There's nothing behind it. You just can't substantiate it. And Joseph Smith, this is the reason why when people come up with critical comments or unvirtuous claims about Joseph Smith, I instantly do not believe them, even if I will look into them, because I know his personality. Yeah. I have seen so much that it would be impossible for me to believe that he is just a bad guy. It's just not possible. That's not who he was.
Can I tell you a little story about this? I was involved years ago. Some will remember the case of Elizabeth Smart and Brian David Mitchell. And I was retained by the federal prosecutors to be an expert witness in Brian David Mitchell's competency hearing and then a year later in his trial. And before the competency hearing, I remember the federal attorney calling me up just to kind of go over some last-minute things before I testified. But he's a good member of the church. He's very interested, more than usually interested in church history and so on. And he said, you know, I've been involved in the prosecution of a number of, quote, prophets, end quote, the Lafferty brothers and people like that. And he said, now with Brian David Mitchell, he says, you've been studying his writing and studying his life to help us out on this trial. He says, can you think of any case where Brian David Mitchell ever did anything for anybody else? And I said, no, curiously, I can't. Now, he said, just tonight, to kind of relax myself, I've been reading an account of Joseph Smith taking care of Brigham Young when Brigham had a fever, and Joseph is mopping Brigham's forehead and, you know, tending to him and bringing him drinks and that kind of thing, really devoting a lot of attention to him. He says, I can't remember anybody of these people I've prosecuted ever doing anything like that for another soul. And he says, they all want to be Joseph Smith, but they will never be Joseph Smith, worlds without end, because they're not like him in that regard. Joseph wasn't in it for the main chance. He wasn't doing it to feather his nest.
He was a good, kind man.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great observation, a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that. Section 24, let's pick out a few choice verses in 10 minutes or so,
okay,
or 15 that we have here.
Well, there's one passage that struck me, verses 13 and 14. It says, require not miracles.
Ah, the Oliver Cowdery.
Except I shall command you. Except casting out devils, da, da, da. And these things ye shall not do, except it be required of you by them who desire it. In other words, I think the idea is, this isn't kind of a carnival show where we're going to do gratuitous miracles all the time. Yeah, don't believe the miracles have stopped. They haven't. But don't be showing off. And don't demand them. Don't demand signs. I mean, by this time, Oliver Cowdery's had a lot of really powerful signs. He holds the priesthood. He's the second elder of the church. But it's not something to be abused. That's what I take from those two passages.
Great, great comment. And that speaks to the way that the first elder and the second elder conducted themselves. They weren't flamboyant. Mm-hmm. They weren't out there trying to make a big show of things. And this was a commandment to keep things down on the basic level, to give service to others, to help people along, as you mentioned, that Joseph Smith was always doing for others.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great observation. Great observation.
And, well, just another one toward the end. Verse 18, thou shalt take no purse nor scrip, neither staves, neither two coats, for the church shall give unto thee in the very hour what thou needest for food and for raiment and for shoes and for money and for scrip. Now this is addressed to Oliver Cowdery, and he will eventually go on a very long mission later that year. But he's told, you know, depend on the people. They'll help you out. We don't do this anymore because there are laws and so on that would get you arrested for vagrancy. But I have friends. I have a friend who served his mission years ago in New Zealand, and he talked about how wonderful it was to go without purse or scrip among the people and the miracles that happened, that people would step forward not knowing that you needed anything but offering you something, which was exactly what you needed, and offering you to stay in their place that night and so on. I'm not sure I would have enjoyed the experience, but in a way I kind of wish I'd had it in the past, or something like that. But this again, the idea was the church was, they were all kind of on the same level of poverty, and the church was going to have to come together and support these people that it's asking to go out and preach or to spend day after day translating. As their work was labor intensive, it took long days, night and morning until night, 6 days at least a week. You took any time off for preaching or translation or dictation and so on, you were losing money, and it's not like you had a big cushion. You'd need help. So,
a quick observation also in section 24, verse 15, I've over the years had a lot of questions about this. Leave a cursing?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Why would you do it? And I think this phrase curse or cursing has a bit more of a negative connotation than it should. And some will say, well, it's a curse. That's pretty negative. What's that? But the real purpose here is that if you keep the commandments, you will prosper spiritually and physically. And if you don't, and one of those would be rejecting the gospel, you're kind of less likely to prosper spiritually or physically. And that could be denoted as a curse, even though we wouldn't look at it that curse has such a negative connotation, but the point is that there are natural consequences that flow from decisions, and this statement here in verse 15 acknowledges that people who reject the gospel just aren't quite going to have the blessings that someone who accepted it would.
Right, right.
I don't see it as any more significant than that.
No, I think that may well be what it is. I mean, the fact is that joining the church will change your life over time in ways that you did not foresee. They can be material or non-material. My father worried for years before he joined the church. I baptized him the night I was set apart as a missionary. But he had worried because he was the head of a business, a construction business, and to pay 10% off the top, that was a lot of money. He told me some years later, he said, you know, the funny thing is, my business picked up. I've never missed the tithing. I made up my mind I was going to do it faithfully, and I never missed it. I've done better since I've been paying tithing. Now, he said, I didn't do it to do better. And I can't guarantee that happens in every case, but in mine it did. Yeah. And I felt that, you know, stepping out, my words, but stepping out in faith, it worked. Or I think of a story that a friend of mine told me. He was down in Honduras. They were visiting the ruins at Copan, and a group of Latter-day Saint people checking out the archaeology down there. And they had a boy that was waiting on them every night at their hotel, serving them food in the restaurant, and his name was Moroni, something or other. And they said it didn't take a lot of deduction to conclude that this guy might be LDS. So they asked him, you know, are you a member of the church? Yes, I am. And they eventually got his story. His father had been the town drunk. And he said he found the missionaries, turned his life around. He was now the bishop. And he said, we owe everything to the church. The church changed our family completely. And so he said, I'm working here to save money for my mission. Well, needless to say, by the way, when they left, they gave him a huge tip. But there was another case of a family whose life, the life of which had been turned around by accepting the gospel. It has those implications. By the same token, not living the standards can get you into trouble. We've all seen that, cases where we see people who make the wrong choices time after time after time, and it ends in ruin. Not always. It's not that simple. If it were that plain, it would be too obvious. But I was just down in St. George a couple of weeks ago and went to look at the graves of some of my ancestors. My grandmother, my grandfather, and the maternal side were there and so on. A bunch of cousins, some of whom had died fairly young, but I was happy to see they died in full fellowship. They were, you know, active and everything. But there was one who died very young, and I happen to know the story. He led a terrible life in some ways, did everything wrong he could do, was eventually stabbed to death by his wife. Mm. And I thought, you know, I knew him when he was a kid. You wouldn't have predicted that, but he just made wrong choices. I'm not going to say that's going to happen to everybody who leaves the church, but I just thought how his life would have been different if he'd taken a different path.
Yeah. Decisions have consequences.
Yes.
They do. Any other comments on section 24? Should we move to 25?
Oh, gosh. yeah, let's move to 25. 25's got some good things in it.
It does. I love this. Emma Smith is an elect lady.
Yes. Yeah.
And people occasionally will ask, oh, what's this elect stuff? Well, that's a great Christian word.
Yeah.
If you're Jewish, you're chosen.
Right.
If you're part of early Christianity, you're part of the elect,
yeah,
of God. And
yeah, the terms in which she's described are very high. I mean, she's also described as God's daughter, you know, and that's pretty remarkable. Now, it does say that all women who accept the gospel and so on are his daughters, but it's pretty strong language. She's praised in high terms. And I know it's fashionable in the church in some ways to look down on Emma. I think we need to resist that. She went through an enormous amount. We cannot really comprehend it. She was very supportive of Joseph in almost every way and finally was just worn out. I think she just couldn't go any further.
Right. And it, in some places, when you get to the time after Joseph Smith is killed,
yeah,
she's faced with the decision of do I support my children or do I support the church? And for her, in some ways, especially with William, that was a little bit more of a real decision than a theoretical one. And she chose her family.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that we can throw very many rocks at Emma Smith for supporting her family. That's a pretty good decision to make. And one of the things that's always strengthened that was that she was always seen as a good, wonderful person. She took care of her mother-in-law, and at the very end of her life, when she finally passes away, according to several different sources, she's seeing Joseph Smith, who's waiting there for her.
Yeah, yeah. And that wouldn't surprise me a bit. I don't feel comfortable judging any of these people. I wasn't chosen to play that sort of a role, so not for me to throw any stones. But she is she's described very highly, and all the evidence, by the way, is that Joseph held her in high, high esteem. I remember we talked earlier in the portion about the witnesses, about Richard Lloyd Anderson. One of the things that he argued, he did a collection of Joseph's letters to Emma, and they're just full of expressions of love. One of the things he pointed out was, we don't have any letters like that for any other woman. Some people said, he turned his back on Emma and went after all these other women. You can bet that if there were a love letter from Joseph to some other woman, it would be passed down in most of these families as a treasure. There don't seem to be any.
Yeah.
Now, it's not that he didn't hold them in respect and, hold them in affection and so on, but he was devoted to Emma. And those who think he wasn't, I think, are misreading the evidence. He really was committed to her, and she was committed to him.
Another fascinating, yes, she was very committed to him, and even though they had their difficulties, she stood by him.
Yeah.
And I've always appreciated that. I've always appreciated that. Verse 11 talks about her being called to compile the first hymnal.
Yes.
And I have to say, the very first time I saw a replica of the original hymn book, I thought, she had way better eyes than I did.
Yeah.
So did the earth. This is like some little
tiny.
But if you look at the collection of hymns in there, those are wonderful hymns. That's great. And it speaks to the fact that even though at a very young age, she had some real musical and spiritual insights there to be able to compile that. I've thought, who could you find that was her age in my neighborhood, in my ward, or wherever, and you say, okay, young lady, I'd like you to put together a collection of hymns.
Yeah.
How well would it turn
and
out?
She can't go online and search them out.
Exactly. She does this and does a marvelous job with it.
Yeah. Yeah, she does a really good job. I think it's striking that in verse 7, it says, thou shalt be ordained under his hand to expound scriptures and to exhort the church according as it shall be given thee by my Spirit. For he shall lay his hands upon thee, and thou shalt receive the Holy Ghost, and thy time shall be given to writing and to learning much. She's given a really important role in the church, not just to be the dutiful housewife and mother of the prophet's children, but to take a leading role in thinking and teaching and writing and selecting the hymns. And, how important are the hymns? Some people have said to me, you're not Christian. Da, da, da. I say, look, you want to know the devotional heart of the church? It's the hymnal that we sing. Well, back in the old days, some will remember we used to go to church. And we'd sit on what were called pews in a chapel and that sort of thing. But we would sing. And those hymns become so familiar to us. If you've been around for a few years, somebody just has to start the melody, and you know the words. Oh, you may falter on verse 3 or something, but if you're reminded of it, it'll come right back. You know these things. You know hundreds of lines of hymns. This is how, in one of the most important ways that doctrines are taught in the church, that ideas are conveyed in the church because we repeat them over and over and over again. They're teaching us what to believe, how to pray, how to feel about God, how to feel about suffering and so on, and opposition. That's actually at the heart. I mean, if you want to illustrate what Latter-day Saints actually believe, take people to our weekly sacrament meetings and let them look at what we're singing about, for one thing.
Years ago, I put together a little radio show about LDS hymns as a window into church doctrine and belief. And it really is. If you look at the first hymnal that Emma Smith put together, that gives you a real sense for who the early members of the church were, and hopefully it still does today in our hymnals.
Well, one of the favorite things that I've seen done in the church has been done in my home ward. Not lately. Somebody decided for some reason that this wasn't a really good thing, but I loved it. Every year we'd have a hymn singing sacrament meeting where there were no speeches. People would just stand up, go up like a testimony meeting, and say what their favorite hymn was and why. We had a really good organist who could play anything.
You'd have to have one for that.
but they'd say, well, this really means a lot to me because, you know, when my mother was in her last days, this song really came to me. Or when I was a little child, I learned this one. It meant a huge amount to me. Or it comforted me in the death of my wife. Or, you know, and then we'd sing the first verse or a designated verse that someone would ask us to sing. I loved that because it was a window into the souls of those people. What hymn means most to you and why? And they were often wonderful hymns. I mean, some of my favorites. There are a few sort of clunkers that I don't like. But other people do, so what am I going to say?
Yeah, a few of them have gone the way of... I could hum and mention a few verses,
right,
but I shan't. The Law of Common Consent, Section 26. People, I think, generally underestimate the importance of a sustaining vote in the church, and probably don't realize its historical and current import.
Yeah,
I think this first struck me when I was having a significant discussion with a fundamentalist Latter-day Saint, I guess is the best way to describe him. I don't know. And the idea was, oh, well, you know, all these doctrines of the church, you know, plural marriage and so on and so forth, they continued underground even though they were publicly denied because that was the will of the Lord, and there are all these people who were called to do all these things, but nobody knew about it. That violates this law of common consent, because this section says that nothing of significance in the church is to be done without the common consent of the people. And you just don't find that.
That's right.
In the fundamentalist arena. And frankly, you can't find it in our church because this is so, so very important that it happens at every general conference. And the people who I tell us to say, well, wait a minute, that's not true. It's not like you've got three candidates or something and you cast your vote for one. This is a little different system than we have in election laws, but it's still so very, very, very important because you have to have that common consent.
Yeah, it talks about consent. Not dissent, but consent. You can withhold your consent, I suppose, but the idea is you consent to something. If a congregation voted no on a person proposed for a leadership position, I'm sure the stake presidency, whoever was the relevant authority, would look at that very, very seriously. But, it, you know, one thing that's important about it is when we raise our arm to the square, we are saying, I will support and sustain this person. We sustain. That means to uphold, to help, to not try to undercut. And but the other thing that I think you were getting at is important, that there are no secret leaders in the church. If somebody comes to me and says, well, I was secretly ordained to do X, Y, and Z, I think my response would be, well, maybe you were, but that has nothing to do with me. I'm under no obligation to pay any attention to you, because in the church I belong to, it's all done by public common consent. When the president of the church dies, I know who the new president is when he's announced, and I raise my arm to the square to sustain him. And, you know, they can't say to me, well, the real president of the church is actually so-and-so living in Laverkan. Okay, if you know that, good on you, good for you. But I don't know that, and I don't believe it, and it doesn't fit the order of the church as the scriptures state.
As the scriptures state, and that, for me, has always been the problem with Lauren Woolley and other stories,
yeah.
And I won't go further into that. It's not important. But the other comment about the common consent is that, to some extent, people don't see the importance of it as much, I think, because the church is so careful now that there's rarely a reason to, all right, those opposed, raise your hand. You just, that's very rare to see that. But I remember stories from my father and from my grandfather, and I've seen a few negative votes here and there and at odd times in my life, so that I know this is a real principle. And if there, for some reason, really needed to be a negative vote based on the inspiration of the congregation, that's acceptable and that would be good in the sight of the Lord. And that's why this section is here. But the church is very careful now, and so that's rarely seen.
But it needs to be taken really seriously. This is a serious, solemn act. You know, we call it a solemn assembly when a new president of the church is sustained. And it's a solemn, serious act that you should be doing consciously, not just going through the motions. You've probably heard the story, I love it, of J. Golden Kimball somewhere down in Springville or something, and he's doing the sustainings of church leaders, and he can tell it's a warm day, and half of them are asleep, and the hands are just kind of going up in a lazy way. They're not really paying attention. So without changing his tone of voice, you know, he supposedly says, and all those of you in favor of moving Mount Nebo from this side of Utah Lake to the other side of Utah Lake, please indicate by the usual sign. And about a quarter of the hands go up. Some are looking around a little confused. And so he's, all right, those of you who said yes, meet me tomorrow at 6 a.m. Bring your shovels.
Expression of great faith to move mountains, apparently. That's a great story.
But, you know, he's felt they're just going through the motions. They're not thinking about what they're doing. They need to listen.
It's a very important thing. And another comment that I've heard is, well, when should somebody raise their hand in opposition? And it's not because you don't like someone, or it's not because you think maybe even somebody could have been better at the position, or, you know, something along those lines. You need to know something that's a disqualifier. If you actually happen to know something that would disqualify someone from service, that would be a reason to raise your hand.
Yeah, it's possible there's something that you know that maybe the stake president or the bishop doesn't know and ought to be informed. Then he can say, okay, well, that doesn't rise to the level, or that does. Okay, that's serious.
They can make a decision, and the availability of that action is there and should be understood by people.
But you're right. It's not a popularity contest. It's not saying, well, I think so-and-so would have been a much better bishop. That's not your business. You don't know what went into the calling. I mean, certainly when I was called as a bishop, I thought I could name you 50 people off the top of my head that would make better bishops than I would.
Right.
But,
Final comment from me here, Dan, and then anything you might have, and we'll wrap up our hour, is that I think one of the true showings of faith is when General Conference runs around and you're asked to, you know, sustain certain church leaders, and then it's and all the other leaders as presently constituted.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, can I really raise? I don't know all of them. I don't have the time to do all my due diligence on all of those people. I couldn't even figure out all their names if somebody gave me a day. It'd be tough. That's where the faith comes in and the support comes in. And only if you know of some disqualifying features should you raise your hand. And still, those kinds of requests for an approval, raising your hand, is appropriate.
Right.
And that's why, because you have faith in leaders and the inspiration of God.
Yeah, I know if I were calling someone and there was something that I should have known but didn't know, I would appreciate being told. I had a counselor when I was serving as a bishop who was just first rate. A guy named Chris Rotz, very bright, not that that's necessarily relevant, but it helped. MIT all the way through to a PhD in every degree, very bright. And he would sit at my right hand in ward council meetings, and I'd start to make a decision. And he'd say, "Excuse me, Bishop, have you thought about this?" Well, the fact is I hadn't. And then he was always so apologetic after the meeting, "Bishop, I didn't mean to challenge you. I don't want to seem to be complaining or, you know, disagreeing with you." And I said, "No, Chris, that's why I have counselors. If I'm about to do something stupid, I want you to catch me before I do it. I want to hear from you. I want input." And you know, don't want to overdo it. The bishop doesn't need a coalition going to him to tell him who to call as Relief Society president. You shouldn't call him as a teacher and that sort of thing. But if it's serious, then I'm sure a bishop would appreciate it. They're human. They're mortal. They're limited and finite. We all are. And it would be helpful to them.
Right.
But always being supportive.
Yes.
Trying to help.
And it's the entire church has inspiration, rights, and duties, not just the leaders. We don't blindly follow our leaders. Well, Dan, always a pleasure. Best of luck with the unveiling here at the LDS Film Festival, the Witness film. That'll be fabulous.
I'm looking forward to it.
And for those of you who have joined us, we hope you've enjoyed our Come Follow Me lesson here, and join us again on Interpreter Radio next Sunday right here on KTalk Media from 7 to 9 p.m.